Okay, let's dive in. Picture this. October 14th, 2003, Wrigley Field.
Oh, yeah, I remember this one.
Game 6, National League Championship Series, Cubs versus the Marlins.
And the Cubs are up 3A, eighth inning.
Just 5 outs away from the World Series. First time since, what, 1945?
45, yeah. The air must have been electric. You can practically taste it.
Totally. Just pure anticipation. And then, well, then it
The
happens.
moment everything changed.
Luis Castillo for the Marlins hits this foul ball down the left field line. Moises Alou, Cubs left fielder, he's racing over. It looks like he might just get it near the stand.
Right by the wall.
And then there's a fan, front row, Steve Bartman, wearing his Cubs gear.
Just a fan trying to catch a foul ball like anyone might.
Exactly. He reaches out, the ball glances off his hand, or maybe his glove. I don't know. Point is, Alou can't make the catch.
And Alou's reaction, I mean, it was immediate, wasn't it? Pure frustration, slamming his
He
glove.
saw it right away. And suddenly, all the cameras, all the attention, it just swings onto Bartman.
That poor guy. In his Cubs hat, glasses, that green turtleneck became infamous overnight.
Instantly, the replays start, fans are yelling, the whole mood just plummets.
Yeah, the energy completely shifted. You could feel it even watching on TV. The Marlins definitely sensed it.
Oh, they did. They were trailing 0-3, remember? And then, boom, they score 8 runs, just like that.
Eight unanswered runs. They win the game 8-3, series tied.
And then they win Game 7, go on to the World Series, and win that too. All stemming, arguably, from that one moment, 5 outs away.
It's brutal. And the fallout for Bartman was, well, it was awful.
Beyond awful. His name, his address, all leaked online almost immediately.
Needed a police escort just to leave the park.
Had police posted outside his house? I mean, think about that. The governors of Illinois and Florida were actually making statements.
Yeah, suggesting things like witness protection or maybe he should switch allegiances. Just unbelievable.
It really hammers home how intense that feeling of my team can be, right?
Yeah.
That sense of ownership we feel as fans.
Absolutely. Even though, you know, we don't actually own the team, it's an emotional ownership.
It is. And that whole idea of my team, it gets fuzzy sometimes. Like, remember last year, 2024, with Danny Jansen?
Okay, catcher. Yeah, what was that again?
He got traded mid-game, played for the Blue Jays and the Red Sox in the same game because of a trade finalized during a rain delay.
Wow. That's got to be a first. Talk about temporary membership.
Apparently, it was the first time in baseball history. It just shows how fluid things are for the players and staff.
Yeah, and look at NFL coaches. What's the average tenure? Like 3 years?
Something like 3.2 years, yeah. Which makes a team like the Pittsburgh Steelers stand out even more.
Right. How many head coaches have they had in the last, what, 50 plus years?
Three. Just three. Since 1969, that's incredible stability.
It really is. But when you boil it all down, who really owns the team?
Well, it's the person signing the checks, right? The actual owner.
Exactly. Think about George Steinbrenner and the Yankees.
The no beard policy.
For decades, almost 50 years, that rule was in place, even after he passed away. That's a statement of ownership. You play for my team, you follow my rules.
Yeah, that's a level of control fans just don't have, no matter how passionate we are. It's the difference between, like you said, emotional investment and actual literal ownership.
For sure.
So it got us thinking. If we feel such a powerful connection, this sense of belonging and ownership for a sports team, what about other things? Things maybe even more significant.
Like our communities,
Yeah.
our faith groups.
Exactly. Where does the ultimate sense of belonging lie there? Who's really in charge? That's what we want to explore in this deep dive today.
That feeling of mine can be so strong, can't it? My neighborhood, my group, my,
Well, my church.
yeah, my church. We hear that all the time, and it often comes from a really good place, right? A sense of community, shared values, belonging, which is wonderful. That community aspect is vital.
But if we take a step back, like we need the sports teams, and ask about ultimate ownership, is it really my church or our church? In what sense?
That's the core question. And our source material today points us towards Scripture, specifically looking at who the church truly belongs to.
Right. It suggests that while we connect deeply with our local church community, the ultimate ownership, the foundational belonging, rests with Jesus himself.
And this idea comes sharply into focus in a passage from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 16.
Verses 13 through 20. This is where Jesus is talking with his disciples, really getting down to brass tacks about who he is.
Yeah, it's a pivotal moment. He starts by asking, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Kind of testing the waters.
And the disciples list off the popular theories, you know. Some say John the Baptist, back from the dead. Others say Elijah or Jeremiah or one of the other prophets.
All respected figures, people associated with God's work, plausible guesses from the crowd's perspective.
But then Jesus makes it personal. He looks right at them and asks, "But what about you? Who do you say I am?"
He wants their conviction, not just hearsay.
And Simon Peter, he just comes out with it, no hesitation. "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God."
Wow, what a declaration. That's not just identifying a role, it's recognizing his divine nature, the promised one.
Exactly. And Jesus' response is huge. He says, basically, "You're blessed, Simon, because God revealed this to you, not just human insight."
Right. And then comes the really famous part.
"And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it."
Okay, so much to unpack there. This verse has been debated for centuries.
For sure. A key thing is the wordplay Jesus uses, which is clearer in the original Greek.
Right. He says, "You are Peter," Petros in Greek, which means like a stone, maybe a sizable pebble.
A piece of rock. But then he says, "On this rock I will build my church." And the word there is Petra.
Which means a massive rock formation, a bedrock, a foundation stone. Different words.
So while he's definitely affirming Peter and his crucial role, the foundation he's talking about seems to be something bigger, more substantial than Peter alone.
Yeah, it's not saying Peter is a bedrock, necessarily. Peter himself actually clarifies this later, doesn't he?
He does. In his own letter, 1 Peter chapter 2, he calls Jesus the living cornerstone, chosen by God, precious. And he says, believers, like us, are living stones being built up into a spiritual house.
So Peter points to Christ as the cornerstone, the foundation. We're the building blocks resting on him.
Which leads to the main interpretations of "on this rock" in Matthew 16. What is the Petra?
Well, one view is that the rock is Peter's confession, the truth he just spoke, that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. The church is built on that fundamental belief.
Makes sense. That truth is foundational.
The other view, maybe more common, is that the rock is Christ himself. Jesus is the bedrock foundation upon which his church is built.
Either way, the focus shifts from Peter the man to either the truth he confessed or, more directly, to Christ, who is the subject of that truth.
And notice what Jesus says. "I will build my church," not Peter's church, not the disciples' church, his church.
That possessive is critical. He's taking ownership. He's the architect, the builder.
And then the promise. "The gates of Hades will not overcome it," or sometimes translated, "prevail against it."
Right. And our source material had an interesting take on this. It's not necessarily the church hunkering down defensively behind walls while hell attacks.
Yeah, it could be seen more actively. Like, the gates of Hades represent the power of death and darkness. And the church, as Christ's advancing kingdom, is storming those gates. And they won't be able to withstand the assault. The church is on the offensive.
That's a powerful image. The church moving forward, unstoppable, because Christ is building it.
And it's fascinating that the first time the word church ecclesia even appears in the Bible is right here.
In response to the question of Jesus's identity.
Exactly. Who Jesus is intrinsically tied to what the church is and what it's meant to do. It's not just some club or human institution. It's supposed to reflect him.
Which means we need to think about church beyond just, you know, the building on the corner.
Definitely. It's not the bricks and mortar. It's the people. The global historical community of everyone committed to Jesus.
His followers. And he gave them instructions, didn't he, before he ascended?
Yes, the Great Commission. It shows up in a couple of places. Acts 1.8, "Be my witnesses everywhere. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, ends of the earth."
Spreading out.
And Matthew 28, the end of that gospel. "Go make disciples of all nations, baptize them, teach them to obey everything I've commanded you."
And crucially, the promise attached. "And surely I'm with you always, to the very end of the age."
He's present with his church as it does his work.
So if the church is this global body of people following Jesus's commands, empowered by his presence, our connection to it becomes really significant.
Yeah, you know, sometimes we think of ourselves as like bodies that happen to have a soul or spirit inside.
Right.
But maybe it's more accurate to say we are souls, we are spirits, and we currently have bodies. Our essential identity is spiritual.
Jesus even asked, "What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul?" Puts things in perspective.
It does. And if our core is spiritual, then our relationship with the church, which the Bible calls the body of Christ, even the bride of Christ, that relationship reflects our relationship with Christ himself.
It's inseparable, really.
Think about it this way. Imagine someone comes to you and says, "Hey, I really value you. I want a deep relationship with you, but I want absolutely nothing to do with your spouse."
Yeah, that wouldn't fly. It wouldn't make sense. You're a unit.
Exactly. You can't genuinely connect with one while rejecting the other half of that union. In the same way, you can't really say you're connected to Christ but want nothing to do with his body, his bride, the church.
It's the primary way he works in the world now.
So belonging to the church, engaging with it, isn't just an optional extra for a Christian. It's fundamental.
Okay, but what about those keys of the kingdom of heaven that Jesus gives Peter right after the rock statement? What does that mean?
Ah, yeah, Matthew 16:19. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven.
Sounds like a lot of power. Like, Peter gets to make the rules.
It certainly signifies real authority, but the source material clarifies it's not, like, a blank check for Peter or even the church leaders who inherited that responsibility to do whatever they want.
Okay, so it's not independent authority.
No, it's delegated authority. Think about getting the keys to someone's house or car.
Right, you can open the doors, you can use it, but you don't suddenly own it.
Exactly. You're entrusted with access and responsibility, but you're expected to act according to the owner's wishes and for the intended purpose of the house or car.
So the keys represent the authority to lead the church, to make decisions, to guide its mission.
But always in alignment with Christ's teachings and his will. Binding and loosing means discerning and declaring what is already bound or loosed by God according to his word. It's about implementing his agenda, not inventing their own.
And we actually see this playing out later. Even Peter, holder of the keys, wasn't above correction.
Right. The Apostle Paul confronts him publicly in Galatia because Peter's actions were hypocritical and not in line with the truth of the gospel.
So even someone with that level of delegated authority is still accountable to Christ and his truth. The authority isn't absolute in the person.
Precisely. It's conditional on obedience to the one who gave the keys, because ultimately it's his kingdom, his church. He's the owner.
So wrapping this all up, it seems the core idea is shifting our perspective from my church in an ownership sense to Christ's church, which we are privileged to be a part of.
Yeah, recognizing his ownership, his foundation, his authority, his mission.
Which leads us to a final thought, something for you listening to maybe mull over. If the church truly belongs to Christ, if it's meant to be his body reflecting his character and carrying out his purposes, what does that really mean for how you engage with it?
How does his ownership change your perspective on your involvement, your priorities, maybe even your frustrations or your hopes regarding the church community you're part of?
What does Jesus actually want for his church? And how should that shape what you want for it and how you participate in it? Something to think about.